and welcome to the Deep Dive Radio Show. As always, I'm your host, Nick Espinoza, and we're going to be talking about all things cybersecurity, cyber warfare, and technology related, and I think we're one of the only ones out there that's doing that right now. If you'd like to be part of the radio show in any way, shape, or form, you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Nick AESP. Again, that's Nick AESP. Or you can send us an email to questions@securityfanatics.com. We have an action-packed show as always. There's always a lot to cover, so stick around with us as we deep dive into a topic and we catch up on everything else. So without further ado, let's begin. And we've got a great hour for you this week. Obviously, we're going to be catching up on the news as well as the top 20 worst passwords of 2021. We're going to be going through a few of those data breaches, but also some of the most worrying statistics for 2021. And our deep dive segment is entitled Social Media is Killing Intellectual Humility. And I wanted to make this essentially the last show that I did, the last deep dive that I did for the year, because we are living in politically divided times. And by virtue of that, we have to understand really how to talk to each other, but we also have to understand that we don't know everything, that we can be wrong, and that social media is essentially reinforcing the fact that we never think we are. So stick around for that. It's a great topic. I really enjoyed doing that. And as always, let's start with the news. And in the spirit of the close of the new year, or rather I should say the close of 2021, I wanted to do the 20 worst passwords of 2021 because, people, we can honestly do better here. Now, if you remember in 1987, comedian Mel Brooks made fun of the password 12345 in his movie Spaceballs. You know, oh, that's the same thing I have on my luggage, you know, that kind of thing. But here's the not so funny punchline. That same bad password is number 3 out of number 20 this year in 2020. And despite countless data breaches, tons of people are still using terrible, terrible, easily guessable, non-unique passwords. Now, this information is coming from NordPass, which is a password manager provider that recently went through essentially 4 terabytes worth of data from independent data researchers to see essentially what passwords were the most frequent. Now, obviously, they're the ones that put this together, but I am not necessarily, this is not a recommendation or otherwise for NordPass. They're just the ones putting it there. So with that, here are your top 20 horrible, horrible passwords, most used passwords for the record, of 2020 as well. This is absolutely nuts. Now, number one is simply 123456. I mean, come on, honestly. Number two, 12345678 9. How unique. Number three, as we mentioned, same thing you've got on your luggage, 12345. Now, number four clocks in at QWERTY. That is essentially the top row from QWERTY. There you go. Very easy to type in. Number five is password. Number six is 12345678. Number nine is 111111. Number 10 is 123123. Number 11 is 12345678910, followed by 123457, followed by QWERTY, all lowercase, 123. In fact, all of these passwords are all lowercase if you hear me say a letter or a word. After QWERTY, 123 is 000000. Followed by 1Q2W3E. Just look at the keyboard and you can see 1 is next to Q, 2 is next to W, 3 is next to E. Come on, people. This is nuts. After that, it's AA12345678, followed by ABC123. Find out what it means to me. Now, after that is password 1, all lowercase. Everybody knows you should use password 2 because the attackers just don't know that one. I'm kidding. Don't use that one. After password 1 is 1234. After that, it is QWERTY UIOP. In other words, the entire top row of letters on the keyboard, followed by 123321. Like, nobody's going to guess that. And finally, in the number 20 position is password 123. Now, all of these can be cracked, for the record, in less than 1 second. So they are pretty much useless if you have this password. In fact, if I am running an attack, simply what we'll do is we'll run things like a dictionary attack, which will take care of a good chunk of these. But we'll also basically grab these kinds of lists to say, okay, we know the top
you know, 100,000 passwords, and we'll just rip through those, trying one after the other until we find it. And usually it's very easy. But if we have to actually have to crack the password, all of those are useless, can be done in under essentially 1 second. So with that, if I'm showing you the horrible passwords, and for the record, if I just told you your password on air here, please, while you're listening to this, go change that password wherever you're using it. But here are some great tips from the Electronic Frontier Foundation, the EFF, in making a good password. So take note here, this is what constitutes a good password. First, don't include personal information. So name, nickname, name of your pet, birthday, anniversary, your street name, anything that could be associated with you that somebody could basically find out on social media, or, you know, in a conversation with a stranger at a bar or on an airplane, or any one of those things. If you're giving those things out, oh, yes, my kids are Bobby and Sally. Well, guess what? You probably have passwords that have Bobby and Sally or their birth dates that might be public record because you're posting publicly on social media. It says, happy birthday, Bobby. Your birthday is January 5th. I don't know, whenever. So make sure you're not using personal information. Next, make it long. Make it long. I like to say a minimum of 9 characters, but the longer, the better. And also from 4 character sets, use uppercase, use lowercase letters, use numbers, and use special characters like question marks, exclamation points, dashes, all those kinds of things. Overwhelmingly, most systems online as you're creating passwords will allow you to use those kinds of characters. And if it isn't when you're logging into a website, then that is deeply suspect. They're running older technology. They are less secure, most likely. Also, and I can't even believe I have to say this, but don't use any of the passwords I just listed. Make them unique. It's obvious, but please make sure they're unique. And finally, don't reuse passwords. It's so easy to be lazy with this, and you've got that one password that opens up everything. But if somebody gets that one single password, they do things like run password spraying accounts, and they can essentially unlock all of your accounts. And so make sure that you're varying those things up. It is so, so important. And if your password for Facebook is the same as your bank, please go change that right now. So many Facebook employees can simply read your password. And finally, and the EFF didn't mention this, but I'm going to mention this. On top of this, make sure you're enabling multi-factor authentication. You can download an authenticator app and essentially pair that to the Facebooks, the Amazons, the Googles of the world. So when you log in with that good password, it can then prompt you essentially to type in a code that changes every 30 seconds or so. It's usually a 6 or 7 digit number. That basically prevents anybody from stealing that password. And if they do, they don't have your phone. They don't have access to that code. And you can basically turn that feature off by marking your browser on your computer as safe. And so at home, you won't see it when you log into Facebook or Amazon or whatever. But as soon as you go somewhere else and log in, you will get prompted for that code. So it doesn't actually slow you down once it's set up, and it takes about a minute or so to do. So those are essentially the worst passwords. That's how you fix it. And so I thought that was some interesting 2021 just stats for the year. And in Amazon news, Amazon had a massive outage, and we'll get to that in a minute here. But the point of this news segment on Amazon is it really underscores the fact that we are too dependent on a few big tech providers. And here's what's going on. Now, in basically, I read this from the Associated Press, and it kind of stuck in my brain. I thought it'd be a great news segment. I could have done a deep dive on this, but that's not what I wanted to do for my last one for the year. And think about it this way, in terms of the massive Amazon outage. If you recall, about from when you're listening to this, a week or two ago, Amazon had an outage across the eastern seaboard of the United States that caused a ton of stuff to go down. Robotic vacuum cleaners wouldn't start. Doorbell cameras stopped working, basically. Amazon had to cancel a zillion deliveries because their internal infrastructure went down, so they couldn't actually process orders. Netflix and Disney went down. The Associated Press couldn't actually publish articles either because they're all backboned on Amazon Web Services. And that doesn't include the countless million small minor apps that you might be playing, whether it's a game or a productivity app or all those kinds of things. This is a huge, huge problem. Now, this major outage in Amazon's cloud computing network basically a week or two ago severely disrupted services at a wide range of U.S. companies for hours, which obviously raises the questions about vulnerability of the internet and how its concentration in a few hands, if you will, it really is underscoring this problem here, because we are putting a lot of our eggs in one digital basket or in a couple of digital baskets. Now, Amazon has still said essentially nothing about this. They've given a little bit of statement on this, but Amazon is notorious for not actually telling us what's going on here. And so there you go. The incident was at Amazon Web Services facilities, mostly affected the Eastern United States, but still impacted everything from airline reservations, auto dealerships, everything I mentioned before, payment apps, video streaming, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so this is something that cybersecurity experts, including myself, have been warning for years about the potential ugly consequences of allowing a handful of big tech companies to dominate key internet operations. As I mentioned, I am one of these voices as well. And I mentioned this exact point when Level 3 got hit a few years ago. That's a massive internet provider that's basically internal to the internet. Half the internet went down in the US a few years back on that one. Amazon had an outage of this ilk in November of 2020. When Facebook went down, they went down for 6 hours, losing $1 billion an hour, which is a drop in the bucket compared to what Amazon was losing. And so think about this. Amazon is the largest infrastructure provider. So a ton of internet sites and apps and everything else, those little IoT devices, all rely on them for essentially total uptime. An AWS outage literally costs billions of dollars per hour, not just for Amazon, but for those customers, those complaints, those companies that are relying on them. It's a huge thing. Now, among the most influential organizations to rethink its approach of depending on a single cloud provider was actually the Pentagon. And this is what we're talking about here. We have to make sure that we are using multiple cloud providers, especially if we're creating those apps of the world. And so the Pentagon did this. In July, they canceled a disputed cloud computing contract with Microsoft that would have eventually been worth $10 billion. And so they are now pursuing a deal between Microsoft and Amazon and possibly other cloud service providers such as Google, Oracle, and IBM to essentially split up the load. Meaning if they're backboned on Amazon and it goes down, they can kick into IBM or Microsoft or, you know, take your pick. That's essentially how we all should be looking at this. And I can't tell you how many times I've walked into a company and says, oh yeah, we are developing, you know, this on Amazon AWS or Microsoft Azure or IBM or whatever it is. And my question is, okay, great. What happens when that goes down? You know, it might be backing itself up, but if it goes down, it goes down. And here we are. Also, the National Security Agency earlier this year awarded Amazon a contract with a potential estimated value of $10 billion to be the sole manager of the NSA's own migration to cloud computing. This contract is known by the agency codename Wild and Stormy, and the General Accountability Office in October sustained a bid protest by Microsoft, finding that certain parts of the NSA's decision were unreasonable, although the full decision is classified. And this is also one of those internal gripes that Microsoft has against Amazon and Amazon has against Microsoft. So, for example, when Microsoft won that $10 billion Pentagon contract, Amazon sued because they won that under the Trump administration. And Amazon's contention was, well, then President Trump really hates Jeff Bezos. They've got a public feud. And so then Trump basically secretly told the Pentagon not to pick Amazon due to his feud with Bezos. And so Amazon's contention is, we're bigger, we're better. And just because, you know, the former president hates our CEO, hates our founder, we lost. And there you go. And so now, obviously, the Pentagon is revising that. But if you are developing anything, make sure that you are putting it on multiple places. The internet was designed to be confederated. And as we have moved to the cloud, that confederation has basically consolidated into a few large players. And when one of them have a problem, we all do. It's a total stoppage. I mean, imagine not being able to get into your internet-connected car because the app on your phone can't unlock the doors. That's what we're talking about with the Teslas of the world. And so, obviously, it's a huge problem. We'll see where this goes, but, you know, it's just crazy. And so that is your large internet infrastructure provider news of the week. And in foreign government news, foreign governments are purposely spreading COVID-19 misinformation. Now, here's what's going on. This is coming from CyberScoop, and I thought this was really interesting. Again, I could have done a deep dive on this one as well, but again, that's not the way I wanted to go. So Here we are. On July 24th of this year, a Swiss biologist, Wilson Edwards, claimed on Facebook and Twitter that the United States was pressuring the WHO or World Health Organization to blame the origin of COVID-19 on the Chinese government. Within an hour, Chinese officials were then promoting that message on social media, using the apparent claim to turn public opinion against the U.S. after China attracted scrutiny for reportedly rejecting further investigation into the origins of the virus. But Wilson Edwards, the Swiss biologist, isn't real. The Swiss embassy in Beijing announced that on Twitter on August 10th. So instead, the ruse was part of an elaborate coordinated campaign based in China to discredit the United States. And that's according to researchers at Meta, which is now the new name that Facebook has. And they put out this report about a week ago Wednesday. Now, what the researchers found was a, quote, hall of mirrors, and that's according to Ben Nimmo, Global Information Operations Threat Intelligence Lead at Facebook. In total, Facebook removed 524 Facebook accounts, 20 pages, and 4 groups, as well as 86 Instagram accounts as part of this network. The network targeted primarily English-speaking audiences in the United States and the United Kingdom, with Chinese state infrastructure companies sharing these posts. Now, the fake accounts basically all followed a similar posting pattern. Before and after the Wilson post, hundreds of accounts posted basically the same links to news articles and social media posts praising China or bashing the government's critics. Now, Meta, aka Facebook, found 2 occasions in which accounts in the network published the designated links along with the directions for the campaign, which instructed the accounts when and what to post, as well as to how to track engagement, meaning they essentially slipped up, Facebook caught on, and they were able to knock this out. And this really, I think, underscores a problem that we see in the Facebook world and social media world in general. There is so much disinformation out there and misinformation out there that is then being spread by basically just an absolute ton of people. This could be fake data on COVID-19. This could be, oh, let's try a home remedy to prevent this, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Gargling, even though COVID oftentimes enters through the nostrils, which gargling doesn't help with, et cetera, et cetera. So, I mean, these are things that we have to combat with. But when we see essentially what appears to be state-sponsored influence in these campaigns to drive a wedge into society, that's a huge, huge problem. This campaign was not that successful, according to Facebook, but there are others that are and continue to be. In fact, there was a recent report that showed about only 12 people are basically accounting for essentially 80% of the misinformation that is basically being put out there on COVID-19 and all of that. And again, I don't care what you believe, et cetera, when it comes to these kinds of things. Just understand that this is a money-generating opportunity for a lot of people, or it's a foreign intelligence opportunity for a lot of countries to continue to drive a wedge into an already wedged and divided society. So there you go. Huge problem. I'm glad it was caught and put down, but understand that some of the information you may be reading could be put out by a foreign government purposely intent on delivering lies to you. So please, please, please make sure that you are honestly and legitimately researching with good sources everything that you are trying to spread, especially if it feels urgent to you. So with that, that is your foreign government misinformation, disinformation news of the week. And in future tech news, and I absolutely love this one, the next big data storage device could actually be your own DNA. Take that, Johnny Mnemonic. Here's what's going on. This is coming from Gizmodo. The world has a data problem. Each day, we create another 2.5 million gigabytes of data, and each year, the amount of data produced globally increases exponentially. This puts us on a collision course with a serious problem. The rate at which we produce data is outpacing our ability to store it. If every YouTube video we watched, every photo we took from our phone, every document we saved was stored on a traditional flash memory chip, it would consume 10 to 100 times the expected supply of silicon by 2040. What's clear is that we need another way to store data, and not just any way. This data method, the storage method, essentially needs to be robust, but it needs to be very dense. We need to pack it in, and that's where DNA comes into play. Where hard drives use zeros and ones, DNA storage uses four chemical bases. These four compounds connect in pairs that create the rungs on the double helix ladder, if you've ever seen that representation of DNA. It turns out that you can use DNA to convert those ones and zeros into four letters for storing complex data. Now, Microsoft, which is one of the pioneers of DNA storage, is actually making some headway on this, working with the University of Washington's Molecular Information Systems Laboratory, or MISL. The company announced in a research paper the first nanoscale DNA storage writer, so we can actually start writing data in DNA format. It's incredibly slow right now, but we're on that road. Now, Microsoft is one of the biggest players in cloud storage, and so looking at DNA data storage to gain an advantage over their competition, basically because it has unparalleled density and sustainability and shelf life, really makes sense. DNA is said to have the density of capable of storing 1 exabyte or 1 billion gigabytes per square inch. And so that is basically massive, massive, massive magnitudes larger than what our current best storage method is, which is known as linear type open magnetic tape, or LTO, can provide. So what is these advantages here in the real world? Well, essentially, the prediction is that data storage demands will reach 9 zettabytes by 2024. That's just 2 years away. And as Microsoft notes, only 1 zettabyte of storage would be used if Windows 11 were downloaded on 15 billion devices. So that obviously is a huge, huge thing. Windows 11 just came out. Using the current methods, that data would need to be stored on millions of those LTO tape cartridges, the densest thing we have so far. So using DNA, 9 zettabytes of information can then be stored in an area as small as a refrigerator. There you go. So scientists say, just as a fun fact, that every movie ever released could fit essentially in the footprint of a sugar cube if you were using DNA storage. And so obviously we're a little bit away from this, but this is incredibly promising. And as we continue to work on this, we are going to essentially see this, not to mention, things like great for the environment, much less footprint than these massive data centers, much less energy consumption. This is just nothing but good news. So hopefully your next data storage in the future, by let's say the next few years, could be your own DNA. And so that is your future tech news of the week. And in U.S. government cybersecurity news, the U.S. government has a cybersecurity hiring problem. And truthfully, honestly, so does the entire planet. But here we are, we're going to focus on the U.S. government because they are facing what they're calling a brain drain of cybersecurity professionals. And this is what experts are warning about. And this is just as the nation encounters unprecedented cyber threats, basically engineering by everyone from ransomware gangs to foreign adversaries. We saw some spectacular data breaches in 2021, such as Colonial Pipeline, not to mention hits on the government itself. It's absolutely nuts. Now, in the competitive cyber field, the federal government has long struggled to keep up with the private sector, which also has a serious need for cybersecurity professionals, but can typically pay higher than many federal agencies. And that is one of, I think, two critical problems that the government essentially has here, is that government work, quite frankly, doesn't pay really well. So the only ones you're really going to attract are those that are willing to take a massive pay cut, because cybersecurity is a rather lucrative field. It's a well-paying field, to take a pay cut, in the name of patriotism to defend the country. And so that obviously is a huge, huge problem. The other side of this as well is that the federal government, specifically outfits like the FBI, that has a desperate need for things like, hackers and all that kind of stuff, they have a zero tolerance when it comes to drug use. And now we are living in an age where things like marijuana, cannabis, etc., are becoming legal. And there's the balance. And if you, let's say, flunk that drug test for the FBI, you might be great at your job and you're flunking that drug test. But here we go. They can't take you. That's obviously a huge problem, where the private sector doesn't care. They really don't anymore. And so here we are. Now, according to Erez Lieberman, basically the former deputy chief of the U.S. Attorney's Office for the District of New Jersey, who specialized in prosecuting cyber crimes, and I quote, "We are in an absolute war on talent with respect to info security and cybersecurity. We've got to make sure we have the people in place to both play defense and play offense." And think about it as well. I mean, the government needs researchers too. This is a district attorney's office to look forensically to basically prosecute offenders. These could be things like, sharing of underage illegal material. These could be state-sponsored hackers, whatever it is. We have a wide swath of where basically Luckily, my field is in incredibly high demand, and a recruiting website for cybersecurity jobs funded by the U.S. Department of Commerce states that there are basically 597,767 open cybersecurity jobs nationwide. That's 600,000 bodies that cybersecurity is short of just in the United States alone. The last stat I heard previously, like a year ago, was like 500,000. Obviously, it's increasing. Now, this number includes both public and private sector. In the public sector, the job estimates were 38,655 open jobs. And so obviously the vast majority of those, about 550,000 or so, our private sector, but we have a very serious issue. And here is the core of this issue overall for the government. Officials have found that the federal government is lacking in its cybersecurity readiness. The Senate Committee on Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs made recommendations in 2019 detailing how 8 specific federal agencies could improve their digital defenses. An updated report released in August of this year found that a majority of those changes had not been made. The report also gave federal agencies a grade on their cybersecurity capabilities, and only Department of Homeland Security received a grade of C. The State Department, the Department of Veteran Affairs, and others received D grades or worse. And this report was an absolute mess. I remember talking about this earlier in this year where they just found like they couldn't even identify assets. Were they sitting in a closet or were the assets basically stolen and sitting in a foreign capital somewhere? They couldn't tell you. Not to mention the fact that we're running massive technology debt in the government, meaning we are spending more and more taxpayer money to basically maintain older systems. As systems age, more maintenance is needed. Think about that car that you've got. You know, as soon as it's got 200,000 miles, 300,000 miles on it, you're going to be spending more to make sure that car keeps running right. And that's essentially almost in the same vein as what it is with technology. So we have a very serious problem at the governmental level. And like I say, I've said multiple times in the past, if you want your kids that are, you know, just starting out in college to have a good high paying job, meaning get off your couch and actually make, you know, move out money, put them in cybersecurity, because quite frankly, even if they stink at it, they're going to be making bank. We are desperate in my field. So there you go. That is your U.S. government news of the week.
You're listening to Nick Espinoza here on the Deep Dive Radio Show on Huntley Community Radio, WHRULP, on 101.5 FM. And stay tuned to Nick Espinoza here on the Deep Dive Radio Show as we take a quick break for a public service announcement. We'll be back right after that.